I was visiting with my daughter, and we had some downtime, and she was on her phone, and I decided I would work on my sermon. So I started working. It was kind of quiet that day as we were working, and she was playing on her phone, and I was working on my sermon. And she said, "Dad, what is that?" I said, "This is a colored pen here, sweetheart." She said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm working on my sermon." She said, "Wow." I said, "How does that work?" So she looked at my sermon, all the many colored. And I could tell that this little clicker was getting on her nerves a little bit there, you know. And she said, "Why?" I said, "I don't know. It's what I've always done." So I said, "If you're ever around me when I'm working on a sermon, I'll get my pen out and start working." Patience is tolerating those little things. It's one of the definitions. Sometimes insignificant, things that get on your nerves a little bit there. Maybe your spouse does something. Maybe a family member does something a little irritating. The Bible says love is patient. The Bible says that we're to bear with one another. Was Jesus patient? Yes, he was perfectly patient. But does that mean he tolerated everything and he never said anything? He always tried to keep the peace. Is that what Jesus did? Jesus is also the truth. The Bible says, "Speak the truth in love." So he spoke the truth and he acted on the truth. And sometimes just being patient is not enough. It requires acting. I remember I was substituting in an inner city school, and they would call me and send me to different schools, and they sent me to this one school. I'd never been there before, and I soon learned that, I didn't know what it was, that this was the school where if you got kicked out of many of the public schools, they would send you to a special school. That way that you could stay in the school system, they could still get funding. I didn't really know what to expect. I went into a classroom, there were six children. I thought, six, but the desks were spread out 6 feet apart. And I'm like, wow. And they basically said, "Now, we don't really expect much from these kids. We just let them kind of do their own thing. We're going to get, they can go and play on the computer a little bit. We're going to give them a couple assignments." You know, just basically they were telling me, just try to keep the peace through the day. So it ended up being kind of a challenging day, as you can imagine. I think this was second grade, and I found there's a little boy. I got a picture of him right here. Yeah, he looked about like that. And needless to say, at some point during the day, he got a little frustrated by the assignment. He didn't want to do the assignment, and he stood up and he started hitting me. Now, okay, you know, a little second grader's not going to hurt you, and I'm like holding him back, restraining him a little bit there, trying to get him calmed down a little bit there. He just wouldn't calm down. So I had to call the office, because I don't just substitute. I have no authority whatsoever. And they had to take him out and get him calmed down a little bit. Shouldn't I have been more patient with him? Shouldn't I have just let him kind of do his thing, right? Because you're supposed to be patient and loving. But he got in trouble that day. Sometimes you have to act. And we know of children especially that what we expect from them as children ultimately will probably be who they will be as an adult. So we keep this in mind when we're studying Jesus. He was perfectly patient. He was fully God. He was fully man. And he perfectly spoke the truth. And sometimes, as we're seeing today, it could be seen as too direct. The last time we were in Mark, we studied Mark chapter 6. Jesus was walking on water. At the end of the chapter, he landed in Gennesaret. People were bringing sick people to him and were trying to touch his cloak. In chapter 7 is where we'll be today. There's a shift in tone. And I want you to pay close attention to what happens in verse 1. The Pharisees and some teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus. It was a 90-mile journey. They're bringing the big guns in to take out Jesus. And they get there and they spot a major offense. Verse 2. They saw some of Jesus' disciples eating food with hands that were unwashed. These people drove, they walked 90 miles for a sanitary issue? No. This was a ritual washing tradition. It involved a very small amount of water, not even enough to wash their hands, but it was a tradition of the elders, not something in the scriptures. This was an oral tradition passed on year after year, and then they would enforce it on people. Now, understand this chapter, we have to understand that the Pharisees believed that they were saved by being separated from sinners. So if they went into the marketplace and they were ever around any Gentiles, their tradition was that they had to go home and be fully immersed to be cleaned. So these teachers come to Jesus with an attack on his disciples, and really it's just an attack on him. So we're going to be looking here in chapter 7, starting with verse 5. So the teachers of the law asked Jesus, "Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders instead of eating their food with defiled hands?" He replied, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites. As it is written, 'These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules.' You have let go the commands of God and are holding on to human traditions." And he continued, "You have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God in order to observe your own traditions." So what were they talking about? A tradition. This was not something, there was no law out here that the disciples, any person had to wash their hands. But this was a tradition. The idea that they're saying is, why aren't you following our traditions? They added their traditions to the law of God. They made their traditions higher than God's law. Did you see what Jesus told them? He said, "Isaiah prophesied about you." Isaiah 29:13 says, "These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me." Jesus is telling them, you're just giving lip service to God. You're focusing on appearance, you're focusing on traditions, but God looks at the heart. So we all have to ask this question, what does our heart look like to God? We can appear so Christian, we can appear so religious, we can seem so godly, but what's in our heart? Well, these teachers were using their traditions to make God's laws useless. They were pitting their tradition against God's law, and they were canceling God's law out. There was one law called Korban, which was giving a gift to God. And the rabbis used this law. They found a loophole in it so that all the people could give their all of their money to the temple or to them when they died. And then they wouldn't have to, and they didn't have to give any money to their parents when they grew old. This was one example. Verse 13, Jesus says, "You do many things like this." Jesus calls the crowd together, and then he says, "Listen to me." So let's all listen very closely to what Jesus says. He says, "Nothing outside a person can defile them by going into them. Rather, it is what comes out of a person that defiles them. Sin doesn't come from your stomach. Sin doesn't come from your hands. It comes from your heart." The disciples don't understand. So they, after the crowd goes, they ask Jesus what he was talking about. Remember now, Jesus is very patient, but he's also very direct. And this is in verse 17. After he had left the crowd and entered the house, his disciples asked him about the parable. "Are you so dull?" he asked. "Don't you see that nothing that enters a person from outside can defile them? For it doesn't go into their heart, but into their stomach and then out of their body." In saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean. He went on, "What comes out of a person is what defiles them. For it is within, out of a person's heart, that evil thoughts come, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and defile a person." So just following Jesus, just following some of his laws, is not enough to make you clean. It's what is inside us. God is concerned about our heart. A heart is who we are. It's what we really believe. It's what drives our behavior. It's why we do what we do. And the Pharisees were just going through the motions. They appeared very religious, but their hearts are corrupt. And Jesus gives a whole catalog of sin. He's painfully honest here. Did you notice what he said? He said, "Are you so dull? Don't you understand? Sin springs from your heart. It comes from inside you. So what is in your heart? What's in your heart?" God knows your heart. We can find that daily forgiveness from Him, but we have to examine our hearts every day. Now the rest of chapter 7 is very unusual because Jesus encounters unclean people. The kinds of people the Pharisees were told never to associate with. So look in verse 24 of chapter 7. Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it, yet he could not keep his presence secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an impure spirit came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek born Syrian Phoenicia. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. "First, let the children eat all they want," he told her, "for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." "Lord," she replied, "even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." And then he told her, "For such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." She went home and found her child lying on the bed and the demon gone. Jesus goes to the vicinity of Tyre. This is 20 miles southwest of Capernaum. Interesting enough, this is the only time when Jesus leaves the border of Israel. And he goes to an area of extreme paganism. These were the fiercest enemies of the Jews. So why did he go? Interesting enough, it says he wanted to be alone. He didn't want anybody to know it. He wanted rest. But you can't hide Jesus. You know, today they're trying to hide Jesus. Society's trying to hide him, and they don't want his words anywhere out there. They don't want people to ever mention the word Jesus, but it's not going to work. You can't hide Jesus. And when he was there, there was a woman, a Syrian Phoenician woman, who spoke Greek, and she falls before him out of great respect, and she begs Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. Now think about this and take note of this. The devil attacks children. He attacks the most vulnerable. Children suffer terrible abuse, they suffer diseases, and they suffer, in our society, they suffer from abortion. They get killed. Jesus basically tells her, "I've come for the Jews first. They have the first seat at the table." And he uses an illustration. The Jewish people are the children at the table. The Gentiles are the little dogs. Now, it's interesting. This is the only reference I know in Scripture to a household pet. And of course, those of you who have pets, which I think is almost everybody here, almost, you eat before the pets do. At least that's how I've seen it done. Maybe it's a little bit different in your house. But this woman accepts what Jesus says, but she has quite a witty response. She says, "Sir, even the pets get to eat the children's crumbs." In other words, "I'll be happy with the crumbs. Please heal my daughter." And Jesus says, "For such a reply, you may go. Your daughter's healed." So she went home and found her daughter completely healed. So Jesus shows compassion on this mother and her daughter who were not Jews. Jesus is on the move. Verse 13, he left Tyre. He went to Sidon, down to the Sea of Galilee, into the region of Decapolis. And if you figure all that out, that was about 120 miles. And if you look at it on a map, it looks like a horseshoe that they traveled. We don't know exactly why they went that route, but it was still in the region of the Gentiles who the Jews called unclean. And he encounters another unique situation, and we only find this in Mark's gospel. This is in verse 32 through 37. There are some people brought him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk. And they begged Jesus to place his hand on him. And after he took him aside away from the crowd, Jesus put his fingers in the man's ears. Then he spit and touched the man's tongue. He looked up to heaven with a deep sigh, said to him, "Ephphatha," which means be opened. And at this, the man's ears were opened. His tongue was loosened, and he began to speak plainly. And Jesus commanded them not to tell anyone. But the more he did so, the more they kept talking about it, and people were overwhelmed with amazement. "He has done everything well," they said. "He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak." A man is brought to Jesus who had a severe difficulty talking. People had a hard time understanding him. He was also deaf. And they asked Jesus to put his hands on them. You know, and when I'm praying for people, I will often ask the same thing. "Lord, may you put your hands on that person. May you touch them. May you heal them." And he does something different. Don't see this anywhere. He put his hands on the man's ears. And then he spits on his hand and he touches the man's tongue. Totally different than anything we've seen. And spitting in the Jewish culture was considered unclean. So why does Jesus do this? We don't know. But he's the Son of God. He acts according to his will, and his healing was unpredictable. And that might have been the reason why he heals this way. And he looks up toward heaven. He passionately prays to the Father with a deep sigh. He gives a command, "Be opened." And at that moment, he could hear and he could speak. And he didn't even have to go to physical, to speech therapy. The man and the people were blown away. They were astonished. But I want you to notice what they said. Verse 37, "He does everything well." Think about this. Jesus never did anything poorly. I was just reflecting. You know, Joseph, his father, was a carpenter. Can you imagine them like working in the shop, you know? And they're working together. Joseph's over here working, and Jesus is over here working. And Jesus is working on a project, you know, and he says, "How you doing, Jesus?" "Whoa, you're really doing well." Everything throughout his whole life, he did well. "You're doing great." Remember at Jesus' baptism? The Father says, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." So you can trust Jesus, whatever you're going through, if you're to take care of you, because he'll always do it well. When you are in the hands of God and he's taking care of you, he'll always do what's best. I heard about a man who unexpectedly learned that he had a short time to live. He had an aggressive form of cancer, and his friends were in grief, and they were shocked, and they started giving him all these remedies. And he said, "Listen," he said, "be at peace with this, because God does all things well." And the man died 6 months later, or 6 weeks later, and he's at peace with God. So Christians, you can always trust God to take care of you, because he's going to do it well. So we move on to chapter 8. He's still in the region with the Gentiles. And for 3 days, he had been with the same crowd. So we start in verse 1. "During those days, another large crowd gathered. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, 'I have compassion for these people. They've already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way, because some of them have come a long distance.' His disciples answered, But where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them?' 'How many loaves do you have?' Jesus asked. 7, they replied. He told them to sit down on the ground. And when he had taken the 7 loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave it to his disciples to distribute to the people, and they did so. They only had a few small fish as well. And he gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterward, the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls, broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 people were present, and he had sent them away. And he got into the boat with the disciples, and they went to the region of Dalmanutha. So here we have another crowd. Now remember, just recently Jesus had fed 5,000. This is clearly a different crowd, because these were Gentiles. And there's only 4,000. And the other crowd had only been with Jesus for one day. But notice Jesus' tireless compassion. Verse 3, I have compassion for these people, for they've been with me 3 days. So Jesus broke the loaves, the 7 loaves and the few fish, and the miracle happens again. And 7 basketfuls remain, and Jesus sends them away, and he leaves in the boat with his disciples. Verse 11, the Pharisees come out to question Jesus. Now this Greek word is more than just a dispute. It literally means they came out to harass him. Things are getting very hostile here. Remember, they had called Jesus' works, his miracles, works of Satan. And now they're coming to him and they're asking him for a sign from God. Once and for all, Jesus, prove to us that you're God. Verse 12, Jesus sighed deeply. I thought Jesus was always patient. I thought Jesus just gave everybody what they wanted. But this is nearing the end of his patience. Jesus says, why does this generation ask for a sign? No sign will be given it. See, God limits his patience. He just doesn't give in to people's demands. Jesus stands up to those who have hard hearts, who have agendas, who really don't want to do God's will. So they get into the boat, they cross over to the other side of the lake. And what are the disciples worried about? What is on their mind? I want to bring out this passage here, and I want you to know, I would say very, very few times have preachers even preached on this passage right here, verse 14, chapter 8. The disciples had forgotten to bring bread, except for 1 loaf they had with them in the boat. Be careful, Jesus warned. Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. They discussed this with one another and said, it is because we have no bread. Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves for 5,000 people? How many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? 12, they replied. And when I broke 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls did you pick up? They answered, 7. And he said to them, do you still not understand? Well, they get into the boat and the disciples figure out, oh no, we only have 1 loaf of bread. And so they start talking about it. And just like preachers do, Jesus decides to use the bread as an illustration. He says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. And when he gives a warning, we should pay very close attention. The Bible, leaven is used for an influence that corrupts or destroys. Just a little bit can alter everything it's mixed with. The Pharisees could appear so godly, but inwardly they were still so corrupt. So did the disciples hear what Jesus said? No, because they were talking about bread. And then Jesus says, why are you talking about having no bread? See, they totally missed the point. Jesus has words with them. You know, I've done 2 miracles. I fed 5,000. I fed 4,000. Do you still not understand? And 2 times he asked this question, are your hearts hardened? Now the disciples might have said, you know, I think Jesus is having a bad day here. Jesus is kind of stressed out. He's just so irritable. We're just talking about bread. This isn't impatience, though. Jesus is confronting them for having a hard heart, for not being open to the teachings of God. The fact is, Jesus is expecting things from his disciples. And it's true of us. How many lessons and sermons have we heard? And the words go one ear, right out the other ear. Our minds are on other things. Sometimes we're thinking about food, or we're thinking about our checking account, or in our economy today, we're thinking about a retirement account. And churches sometimes focus on budgets and buildings instead of what the Bible says. And the disciples focused on that one loaf. Think about this. And Jesus had just done two great miracles. He fed 9,000 people. Jesus is teaching them, and his words are bouncing right off their heart. God is patient, but don't think that he doesn't get angry when we don't listen to him or when we act like we're listening to him. Sometimes a stern word from God is needed. And sometimes there's just not a painless way to speak the truth. Well, Jesus isn't done yet. They come to Bethsaida. This is a village where Peter, Andrew, and Philip come from. And we learn in another gospel that this was a village of little faith. And then we have the short account of a man who is blind, who Jesus heals, but it doesn't happen right away. It comes in two stages, and it certainly wasn't because Jesus lacked the power. There was a purpose for his gradual healing, and Jesus takes the man aside privately. He spits on his eyes. He puts his hands on him, and once again, this healing is different than Jesus' other healings, and God works in mysterious ways. He heals in mysterious ways, but certainly the man's eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and Jesus healed the man completely. There were no partial healings in Jesus' ministry. Now, the first part of Mark takes place around the Sea of Galilee. Now, it moves 25 miles north to Caesarea Philippi. So we're looking again, chapter 8, we're going to move on to verse 27. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say that I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist. Others say Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say that I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." And Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. Now this is unusual because Jesus had done a lot of teaching of the disciples, but here he questions the disciples. He says, "Who do people say that I am?" "Some say John the Baptist. Some say Elijah, one of the prophets." Then the big question, I think this probably put him on the defensive a little bit. "Well, who do you say that I am?" And then Peter answers for everybody, "You are the Messiah." Now the words we're most familiar with come from Matthew 16, 16. And these are the words that church members say when they come forward and become a member, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." Peter says, "You're the anointed one. You are the predicted one in the Old Testament." And here we are halfway through the book of Mark, and this is a key moment. This changes everything right here. The disciples finally get it. But, as we'll see, there is still a work in progress. But it's also a question that we all have to answer. Who do you say Jesus is? A good moral teacher? A prophet? Or is he your Messiah? You know, every single member of this church, even on a low Sunday like this, what I like about this is that every single member, that's everybody here, every single member of the church has made this confession before people. So did you really mean it when you said it? Have you forgotten what you said? Or is he still your Messiah today? Well, Jesus isn't done with his disciples. And now he's going to tell his disciples what it meant to follow him. So let me give you a word of warning here. Verse 32 says, he spoke plainly. It was clear, it was unmistakable. Jesus is perfectly patient, but he's also unmistakably honest. And so I'm warning you because not everybody likes to hear the plain truth. They'd rather have it dressed up with humor or hidden in less offensive language. That's not what it means to speak the truth in the Scripture. So prepare your hearts this morning as you hear these words, starting in verse 31. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and teachers of the law, that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter, "Get behind me, Satan," he said, "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross and follow me. Whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels." Jesus doesn't say, there's a future possibility of suffering. No, he says the Son of Man must suffer. He must be killed. He must be raised. Now this was a total shock because the rabbis had read all these scriptures in the Old Testament, which we've read before, that talk about the suffering Messiah, but they just couldn't imagine the Messiah actually suffering, so they had other explanations. So this is all new to the disciples. And Peter, remember, he just made that great confession. He can't stand to hear it anymore. And he comes at Jesus, verse 32. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Now this is interesting. The word rebuke is the same word that Jesus uses when he denounces a demon. So don't get the idea that Peter's being nice and patient. Well, Jesus, you know, you might want to rethink about that. That doesn't really sound... That's not what Peter's doing here. Peter is being aggressive. I picture him with his finger out, chewing out Jesus. He's aggressive and he's forceful. He says, this is not going to happen. Now, shouldn't Jesus have been patient here? Shouldn't he have been gentle? I mean, Peter is who he is. Just overlook his brashness. No. Jesus calls him out. He identifies the source of the problem. He says, "Get behind me, Satan." Satan is speaking through Peter. He says, "You don't have in mind the things of God." And this is the problem with somebody who's not following Jesus. They're focused on themselves. They're focused on the things of the world. They don't want to have to go through the difficult things that the Christian life is called. Jesus calls the crowd along with his disciples. If you want to be my disciple, basically, he's saying, this is what it involves. And he gives them a few things here. Number one, he says, deny yourselves, take up your cross and follow me. Now, they all knew about the crucifixion because it was Rome's main form of execution. And anyone who was sentenced to die had to take the cross. When they were sentenced, they had to take the crossbeam and they had to carry it out to the point of execution. It was a death of shame. Jesus says, if you want to follow me, you might as well get your crossbeam out and start carrying it around every day, because this symbol of shame is going to be your symbol for following me. Another thing Jesus says, remember, you're expendable. Don't follow me only if you want to save your life, because you're going to end up being condemned. I've heard it said this way, the Christian life is a throwaway life. If you want to follow me, it's going to cost you your life. Well, we hear today that we should live our life to the fullest. Don't put up with anything from anybody. You just live the life that you want. Jesus says that his followers are going to be mistreated. There's really no way to glamorize what he says. The Christian life is one of self-denial. It's one of carrying a cross. And we have to, the third thing he says here is count the cost. Jesus uses economic terms here. Profit and loss. We all do this every month. We get our checking accounts out. We look at how much we spent. We look at how much we have. And hopefully we didn't spend more than we have. We are always counting the cost. Jesus says on one side you have the world. You have the whole world. You have your finances. You have your possessions. You have your status. You have your financial security. You find your happiness. Everything over here is in the world. And then on the other side, you have your soul. And Jesus says, what can anybody give in exchange for their soul? And the answer is nothing. If you lose your soul, you've lost everything. You can have all the financial security, all the happiness, everything that you want in life right over here in the world. The problem is we don't focus enough time on the soul. Jesus died for the soul. If you lose your soul, it means you lose everything. And one of the ways that you can tell that you're a Christian, and we talked about this a little bit in Sunday school, is if you openly identify yourself as a Christian. If the people around you, your family and your friends, they know that you are a Christian. If you're ashamed of Jesus, he's going to be ashamed of you when he comes back. So how's your faith? Now this sermon is a humbling reminder to me because Christians want an easy life. They don't want to hear difficult truths. They don't want to have to go to church every Sunday. They want to go to church. They want a church that makes them feel happy. They don't want to be challenged with how they're living. They don't like the idea of denying themselves. They don't like the idea of a cross of difficulty. A sermon like this is not popular. But Jesus calls us to that life. But you know, in Jesus, we have this perfect patience of God. So patient. He's been so patient with us, hasn't he? He's been so patient with him as we failed him. He sees all that we've done, all that we do. He looks at how long we've been following him. Many of us have been following him a long time. And still, we get hard-hearted, don't we? Still, we're not always obedient. Still, we're doing things we shouldn't do. We have to remember, God's patience will not be forever. One day we'll stand before him. So I know that everybody here has accepted Christ. So let me just make today's message one of rededication. Let's remember what Jesus calls us to do, to deny ourselves, to take up our cross, to follow him. And let's rededicate ourselves to that idea. So let's all stand and let me have a prayer.